But if our farm was a reality TV show, the Giddies would get their own spin-off. Because they're so hilarious. And they're like this little gang that kind of runs around the property. And just yesterday, they caught a frog. Like a big frog. Like a frog the size of my hand.
Wow.
And I had this photo of them kind of biting its leg and flicking it around. So the dogs are scared of the Giddies. They won't go near the Giddies. If the Giddies come around, they start squawking, the dogs kind of back off and get afraid. So it is interesting to watch them all negotiate their kind of roles and places. But overall, he's well. He still has a tendency to chase animals off into the distance forever. So we're trying to teach him the boundaries of the property. But so far, so good.
I think that's our pre-roll right there. Perfect.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
What I like about the goats is they eat weeds. I mean, they eat grass, but they also love eating weeds and bush. So they get a lot of the stuff that you'd otherwise be wanting to get yourself.
Yeah.
We have an incontinent husky now. So.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. Is that like a husky that you've had for years that suddenly became incontinent, or did you acquire the dog and the incontinence together?
No. We've had her for, she's coming up on 10, and we've had her since she was 2. She's a rescue dog. And I don't know, like within 1 year, we brought her in, and she's incontinent, which we knew. She's got arthritis in her back 2 hips. She's got cataract in one of her eyes and a tooth infection. So it was just, it all happened very quickly, but she's on the mend. So
she's back home.
Yeah. She's back home. And after this, I got to go pick up, some hormones they're going to give her to try and work on the incontinence. So otherwise, I have doggy diapers. So my diaper days are back. I got to put my dog in a diaper until this stuff kicks in.
Man.
I thought my diaper days were over until I'm in them, you know?
I was going to say, if the dog diapers are cheaper than humans, that's what I'm going to go for.
They're not. They're very expensive. It's like $37 for a pack of 6. I'm like, are you kidding me? Or a pack of 10? It's pretty ridiculous. Yeah.
Well, do you have a big backyard there in your urban
For an urban parcel? Yes, we have a nice big backyard, and
you're technically suburban, no?
I don't know. I mean, it's Etobicoke.
I mean, it's not the densest of neighborhoods. Like Etobicoke, the urban design of Etobicoke is decent size.
Yeah, you got nice lot sizes, and so it is decent size. So, but well, she's the good, most she's the most lethargic dog on the face of the earth. Anyway, like all she does is sleep all day. I always said my next life, I'm coming back as a husky. That's what I'm doing because.
Anyhow, life.
I
was at an agricultural conference this time last year, and they were all lamenting the rough times that the agricultural industry was in, except for dog food and pet food. That's the one part of the agricultural sector that is booming, that margins remain really large, and the growth opportunities for pet food, I think, even amidst this depression we're heading into, I suspect for many people, pet food will be the area in which they are still spending perhaps a little more than they would their own food.
Well, it's funny. I talked with my best friend from high school on the phone yesterday, and him and his wife are Emily's godparents, and they own a tree nursery, family business, been in the family for a few generations, and I was stunned. I thought, you know, your business is probably dead right now. Why don't you guys come up next week? And he said, are you out of your mind? He said, we've never been busier than we are right now. Yeah. He said, it's like 200% even north. We're short two people. We can't keep up. I'm exhausted. We're selling into Quebec, which has never happened before. I was completely clueless. I said, what's driving it? He says, I don't know. Everyone's locked up at home, and they're probably looking in their backyard and saying, we've got to do something.
Where I live, June 2020 was the great deck renaissance. Mm. Everyone and anyone was refurbishing their deck, building a new deck. Literally every lumber store ran out of treated lumber, ran out of lumber for decks and that you would use. It's remarkable because we're now in this weird kind of economy in which the supply and demand are off because it's driven by psychology. It's driven by, you know, first it was the run on toilet paper. Then I also saw a run on chicken stuff. Like everyone wanted to start raising chickens. Mm. So all the chicks were not available. All the equipment for running a chicken operation all of a sudden sold out. You know, then it went to baking, right? There's no flour. There's still no instant yeast that you can find anywhere, certainly where I live. Then it was Dex. So I keep thinking, I mean, given the trend or the real kind of herd mentality of the economy, if you can anticipate what the big item of July is going to be or August, what everyone's going to rush to get, that's a pretty big business opportunity.
I feel like I wish I had done the introduction by now, so I will take this opportunity to say, welcome to the Access of Easy Salon number 11 with Jesse Hirsch from the Ottawa Valley, Charles Hugh Smith from Hawaii. I'm Mark Jeftovic in the west side of Toronto, and we are here to discuss the happenings of the day. And we talked a bit about it over email. Charles, are we... should we be getting ready for the guillotines?
Well, you had mentioned the French Revolution and written about it, referenced it in some of your recent writings, and we didn't really get to discuss it. And so I want to open the Overton window here a little bit in terms of what could happen to the U.S. Politically, socially, economically in the next 5 years. And so what doesn't seem to be in the Overton window right now, which is a way of talking about what's considered possible, never mind plausible or good or bad, just simply is it even conceivable that something would happen? And I'm wondering if there could be another true revolution, like the overthrow of the entire elite, which is kind of what happened in France, as well as this idea that human nature could be perfected, which of course is always the foundation for the search for ideological purity, which leads to mass executions. I'm hoping to skip that part of it, but I do wonder if the U.S. is actually primed for a revolution in the sense of overthrowing its financial elite class. So that's this topic, but I'm curious about your guys' topics as well. You know, the random comment from Jesse's comment section and your related topic of how political systems change without us being conscious of it.
Well, I've been re-listening to The Sovereign Individual, which I think I've mentioned on previous podcasts, and it just really, I mean, it was written in the mid-90s, and the underlying premise is that what happens in geopolitical transitions is the configuration of violence changes. Like the logic, the business case behind violence changes, and by violence they just mean like the way we're used to it is the nation state has the monopoly on the use of force, on the legitimate use of force. And then when these revolutions come, that logic, that configuration changes. And the part of the book I'm listening to now talks about how everyone at the time really wants to control the nature of that change. They have beliefs and they have desires and they have wishes on how things are supposed to be. But history tends to be a little cavalier and insensitive about it, and it just changes the way it's going to change, driven by its own imbalances and tectonic shifts and its own logic, and it doesn't really care what people want to have happen. It just kind of has this internal logic to it. And what kills me about the sort of these grandiose schemes to guide this change, like World Economic Forum and IMF and stuff, to say like this is the fourth industrial revolution, or it's, you know, some sort of similar initiative, Agenda 2030, whatever, is there, it's that recurring theme that we've talked about here, that everything is changing, all bets are off, there's a new normal, but the incumbents have this ingrained perception that they get to be the ones that keep dictating the terms of engagement and the rule and how that configuration is going to play out going forward. And I think what events and reality are proving to us right now is that that's not going to happen. It's not going to play out the way this carefully managed technocratic sort of idea of how it should play out will play out.
I mean, I think there's an interesting correlation there between deception and description, right? I think you're right that no one's in control. I think you're right that the way in which this plays out is beyond anyone's ability to predict or even influence in terms of the outcome. And yet, I think that there is a capacity, and I think both of you guys are using the word elite perhaps a little too vaguely, because I've always recognized the competing elites, that there is no singular elite in terms of unity or homogeneity, and that it's better to think of society as competing elites, as contested, as battling elites. But to your point, the elites who are largely in power today, I don't think that they need to control, or I don't think that they need to harness the change that's happening. They just need a story that justifies their continuation. And it's interesting the way which they'll use narratives, especially the narrative of crisis, to justify their privilege, to justify their power. And that, I think, is an open question moving forward, whether the financial elite or political elite or celebrities, as we know them, will be able to maintain their position as status amidst turbulence, amidst the turmoil, economic, political, and social, that we anticipate being part of our near-term future. I think that's open-ended. I'm not so clear. And, you know, part of it, I think, reflects what I was sort of comparing here in terms of description versus deception. That I think often, you know, people ascribe a deception to elites or a deception to the ruling class that I'm not sure always exists. I think instead what they use is description, a narrative that just normalizes their rule, that normalizes their status, that normal, you know, and for me, celebrities are the obvious example to this, because at least rich people can say, well, my money is the basis of my power, right? Or states can say, our violence, our ability to use violence is the basis of our power. But what do celebrities use as the basis of their power? Well, celebrity. But at the same time, well, they're a celebrity because they're a celebrity, right? There becomes a kind of feedback loop to the attention economy that the people who are celebrities because they're celebrities, which then affords them a certain kind of attention and power. And that's what I mean by description, that there's, in our narcissistic culture, I think we underestimate the ability for quote-unquote elites to just use description of themselves, of their position in life, as justification for who they are. And I think that's what's particularly interesting about this moment, because often that's not enough. And elites are falling because they have no justification for their power. They have no justification for their authority. So I'm... call me contrarian in that on the one hand, I kind of agree with both of you that the elite, quote unquote, current position or power is precarious and they could lose it at any time. And just like the French Revolution, there could be a wave of unrest and social change that overcomes everything before we know it. I share with you the sense that that could be imminent. But at the same time, I could also equally argue the opposite, that it doesn't matter, you know, what the winds or how the seas change. The elite that we currently have is so secure in their position that they'll just laugh it off and change their story. Yesterday they were capitalists, tomorrow they'll be communists. They don't care as long as they're in power. And that's where I'm kind of fluctuating between both, between their days are numbered and their position has never been more secure. And I think it really depends upon context and circumstance.
You know, it seems that we all three grapple with a kind of juxtaposition or duality in various things that we look at. Like, I was just on a podcast last week, a guy named Doug McKenty, libertarian, does a show called The Shift, and we talked a lot about conspiracy versus incompetence. You know, never ascribe to conspiracy, what can be ascribed to stupidity, and how I tend to be a little more skeptical of the unified cabal at the top that's sort of pulling all the strings, and believe that it's more like a bunch of bumbling half-wit, you know, bureaucrats and career politicians lurching from one crisis to the next, just trying to keep the train on the tracks. And if they can't keep the train on the tracks, plan B is to just loot it for all they can before the train comes off the tracks. And that has a lot of explanatory power when you look at what's going on in the world. It's a similar dynamic. I think that we sort of look at these things and you get paralyzed as to, sometimes I think the tension between the two different polar opposites of whatever we decide to turn our attention to, whether it's narrative, whether it's the structure of power, we look at it and go, well, it could be this, it could be this. And that's a symptom of even the times being what they are, that there's no firmament to anything. Like, there's no objective reality, there's nothing to tie the money system to, there's nothing, all the signaling's garbage. And so anyone who tries to turn their attention to really tease out the signal from the noise really is stuck with this dilemma of these, I don't even know how to describe it, this vice of dissonance in their heads.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on Jesse's comment about the elites that we didn't, using that term broadly is a little deceptive for sure. So I've written a lot over the last decade about and proposed, conflicts within specific elites, like in the U.S., the deep state, where I'm sort of suggesting, and I find evidence for this in public documents, that the sort of dominant geopolitical elite in the U.S. deep state is neoliberalism, right? Like, we're going to create markets everywhere, and the U.S. is destiny is to be the global hegemon, and et cetera, right? And then there's a camp that's, because of overreach and so on, there's a camp within that deep state which is going, let's draw back from that, because that's going to lead us into a spiral down. You know, that we're going to lose the whole machine here if we pursue this kind of open-ended military commitment rather than diplomacy and so on. So there's that conflict between elites, I think, which is ongoing. And then there's the obvious, which is playing out partly in this Trump, anti-Trump thing, right? That the forces that want Trump eliminated from the face of the planet are pretty obvious. You know, they've tried all these different machinations. And then he obviously has defenders, and not just on the streets, but within the power structure. But I think specifically for me, I wanted to focus on the financial elites, because, you know, when I read these, financial stuff, it's always like, oh, well, the market might go down here, but in a decade, everything's going to be fine. And I always think, well, who's to say the stock market's even going to exist in 5 years? Maybe that will be recognized as a fraud, essentially, a mechanism of fraud, and it's going to be shut down. No more stock market. So all you guys predicting that, oh, well, this cycle is this and that, no, it's going to be gone. And is that even possible? And I think it's entirely possible, you know, that there may be some sort of over-the-counter, something equivalent to crypto that you can trade shares or in companies, but it's not going to be the kind of skimming fraud machine that we have now. That will just could be closed down, you know, along with the overthrow of the financial elite. And so, which brings me to my second point. I want to introduce here an author, Edward Lutok, who I'm a big fan of. He's he reached fame early on, I believe in 1969, when he wrote a book about how to stage a coup.
I have that book.
Yeah.
I love that book.
Yeah. And he's written books on the grand strategy of the Western Roman Empire and of the Byzantine, you know, Eastern Roman Empire. So he's this kind of like classic geopolitical guru type guy. And he makes a big distinction here, if we want to talk about dualities, between force and power. And I think a lot of what, when we talk about elites and elites' positions and privilege, we're talking about their power as opposed, part of which is their ability to muster up the forces of actual force. But Lutwak's, and I don't know how to pronounce his name, I'm just pronouncing it as a guess here. His point is power is really cheap because power is persuasive. So to Jesse's point, if you introduce a narrative and a description that people buy into, then they comply with what your plan was. But it's through their own will. Like they go, oh, okay, yeah, I understand. Their story is, you know, they're leading us to prosperity and I should just stay out of the way. Okay. And so then that's power, right? Where force is like, yeah, you have to drag people, you know, and hunt them down, you know, search their house for their gold stash, et cetera, et cetera. That's really expensive. So when elites are forced to use force, they're on their last legs because it means their actual power to persuade people cheaply is being lost. And so when I see these kinds of social disorder in the U.S. and the rapidity with which the cultural elite glommed onto that and said, yeah, me too, you know, we're totally with it, you know, that suggested to me that they were losing power. You know, the power to persuade the masses, and it's just the desperation. It's just so visible in the U.S. And I'm thinking, wow, this is just the very first initial, like little tiny wave of disorder. You know, I mean, this is like a 1 foot wave splashing onto the beach, and when sets of like 8 to 10 to 12 foot waves start coming in, you know, it's going to be a different game. And I don't think most people are even considering that possible. They're sure that the pandemic was this little 1 foot wave that drifted in and, you know, the kids got to play in it.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mark.
Very briefly, it's like going back to the French Revolution analogy. It's like the elites today are like the Girondins, or I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, that they thought, okay, we've accomplished the revolution, we've overthrown the monarchy and we'll just settle into our thrones. But then suddenly they were the next ones being herded up the guillotine steps because they didn't completely factor in that it would take on a life of its own. And that's actually what the Sovereign Individual book says as well, is that these things, these times of reconfiguration of power, they can't be controlled. They can't be controlled. They basically are unleashed, and so they're just marked by extreme social unrest and civil disorder, which I really think is what's happening right now. So I think when you see the Democrats or Jamie Dimon or whoever, or Republicans too, you know, just masks on, take a knee, and okay, yeah, but now we're going to come out with our next wave of regulations, and then they just don't know that it's all going to just kind of collapse in on a pile on itself. There was a movie.
I think one of the underlying themes of what we're discussing and the context of what we're discussing is the failure to appreciate complexity. And I think as a society, on the one hand, we've used technology to dramatically increase complexity and embrace complexity. But it came with the myth or the false hubris that we could understand or control that complexity. And that's what a lot of Adam Curtis's work looks at, is that relationship between the worship of complexity, but really having no control or no ability to deal with it. And I think that touches our conversation in a number of points. On the one hand, I don't think there was ever such a thing as objective reality. I think when you describe objective reality, what you're really referring to is authoritative reality. In that, in most of human history, there was an authority who was empowered to determine authority. That might have been the Catholic Church, that might have been the sovereign, that might have been the nation state at its peak. But the idea of authoritative reality is one of the first things to discard when a civilization starts to collapse, when order starts to fall apart. And I think that ties very much back to what Charles was describing in terms of the institutional collapse, that how many of the institutions that comprise the pillars of our society are weak. They no longer have their power. They no longer have that authority. So they resort to force because they can't persuade. They can't even coerce. So they have to use threats. And, you know, all of this fits within our narrative of the French Revolution. But at the same time, I think we underestimate complexity that is at play. And that's where I personally have never subscribed to the concept of a deep state. I do believe that U.S. intelligence agencies and U.S. intelligence officials can be corrupt and do all sorts of nasty things in concert with other nasty people. But I don't think that they're united. I don't think that they have unity. I think there's camps. I think there's factions. I think there's competing interests. I think there's different ideologies. I think they're united by neoliberalism. But I think the larger unity is desire for power and wealth. And really, pursuing power and wealth, there can be no unity because there's always some other guy who has stuff that you want. And if he's on your side and he still has stuff that you want, that's not going to stop you. So I do agree that shady elements of the U.S. government apparatus have overplayed and been corrupted and done evil shit. I just don't think that they're united. I don't think that they all play on the same team. I think they switch sides, and I think they're largely narcissists who believe in themselves and not country and not some larger ideological ploy, because, you know, power corrupts. Absolute power, absolutely. And I think that's part of the problem of the society we're in, because I agree with your earlier point, Mark, about the kleptocracy, that they'll do everything they can to keep the train on the tracks. But as soon as they start to believe that the train might go off the tracks, well, we better start stealing everything on the train just in case.
That we haven't stolen already.
Right. And I kind of feel that that's where we've been the last 10, 20 years. That we're in the kleptocratic phase of the collapse of the empire, where everyone is looting it to the best of their ability. And again, I don't think there's unity. I don't think they're doing it as a concerted, united effort against the people. I think it's just everyone for themselves. And they're the elite because they happen to have more power, more money, more access than us. So we can see them looting, and we're not in a position to loot because they control the legal system. But to bring it back, they don't have authority and they don't have power. And increasingly, they don't have people's trust. And that's why institutions are failing. That's why the credibility of elites is failing. And that's why there's no authoritative reality, because there is no authority to impose reality on everyone. So we're all reverting to our own realities, which is kind of the state of nature where we experience the world as man. I think to get back into us worrying about the, you know, the Jacobins or the Robespierres, is there could be a YouTuber, there could be a social media savant who is able to establish an authoritative reality, who's able to command the mob, who's able to command the spirit of the revolution for violent ends, to get more and more people into the guillotine. And I think that's where we have to be worried about the desire for purity or the desire for perfection. Because what I think is the real threat is someone who will falsely promise simplicity amidst the complexity. Because we live in a complex society, And I suspect increasingly people are seeking simplicity. And that's why conspiracy theory, that's why paranoia can be so infectious.
Well, would it be a personality or would it be a movement? I mean, you see some of the movements that are in the streets now are putting simplistic ideas on the table.
But movements require personalities. And any movement that's out today, you can, thanks to our surveillance state, actually map those movements to specific personalities. That's part of what makes social media so compelling, is that 9 times out of 10, there is a real human being on the other side. And you know, never, I keep bringing it up in the podcast, never underestimate the talent development, the talent incubation on YouTube, on TikTok, on Twitter, on Instagram. There are phenomenal storytellers, phenomenal propagandists who are plying their craft today in open markets. And all they need is a dictator to rally behind. And they've got way more tools than Goring or any of the other previous masters of propaganda. And that's why I think authoritarianism has a really good chance, because, you know, disorder is around us. And the tools for mythology, the tools for mass hysteria manipulation are certainly ripe and ready to be employed.
I think authoritarianism is inevitable. I think that's whether it's, we're back to the foundation analogy. Is it a 30,000 year dark age or 1,000 year dark age? But that
nothing's inevitable. Nothing's inevitable, provided you're willing to pay attention. Otherwise, let's change the focus of this show to how to be a prepper, how to defend yourself, and how to organize your local militia. I don't think we're there yet. So we can remain in the realm of policy and theory until we have to get to the practical of the next 1,000 years are going to suck. What are we going to do?
I think I cut off Charles, though, who was about to say something.
Mark, you were going to mention a film, and I'm always interested in your cultural references.
It was a Peter O'Toole film called Power Play, and it was about a fictional Eastern European country run by a despot, and the generals decide to overthrow the despot. And it really was a repressive regime, so the military were kind of doing the Lord's work by who's having their backyard excavated. Anyway, so the generals, that's okay, the generals are plotting to overthrow the regime, and they recruit a tank commander who's Peter O'Toole to help them overthrow the regime. And do you want the spoiler? I mean, long story short, they do the coup, and then, you know, the guy who's supposed to be leading the junta comes into the office of the prime minister or whatever, and Peter O'Toole's sitting behind the desk, and he's like, you're forgetting one thing, El Presidente. Those aren't your tanks out there in the street. They're mine. And so the next scene, they cut to, you know, there's the regime. They're like tied to stakes in front of a firing squad, and the camera pans, and beside them is the guy who led the coup, right? And then it cuts back and forth, and Peter O'Toole is reading this speech over the radio station about liberty and freedom and restoration to order, and everyone's being lined up. They're all being shot, and so it was a coup within a coup. It was called Power Play, and I think that kind of dynamic happens in history and could, you know, this sort of implosion of like, okay, now's our moment, let's seize it. And then there's somebody waiting in the wings to say, you know, like Jesse's, you know, cult of personality is kind of waiting in the wings to go, aha. And I'll just briefly touch on this. Very early on in the Donald J. Trump run for presidency, there was a Catherine Austin Fitz. Charles, you probably know who she is. Jesse, maybe not. Worked in the Reagan administration. She does a podcast. Anyway, before she kind of aligned, like, kind of thought, long story short, she surmised or suspected that Trump was a plant by the Clintons to sort of obliterate the Republican field of contenders. That it was kind of like you've seen pictures. They were old buddies. The picture of the Clintons at the Trump and Melania wedding. They got their arms around each other, big smiles all the way around. And so the plan was that Trump was supposed to just throw his hat in the ring to just smoke out all the other Republicans. And then he decided, aha, and he seized all the marbles at the last minute and double-crossed the Clintons, which is why the campaign against them ever since has been so virulent and over the top and unhinged, because he kind of pulled a double cross, which would almost seem in keeping with the guy's personality if it actually played out that way. Jesse looks okay, like his head is about to explode, but go ahead, Charles.
Well, I mean, this is why humans are so vulnerable to stories. Because you could make up any story, and as long as it sounds reasonable, people are like, yep, must be true.
Well, that isn't what we're saying, but there was actually a data point around it that there was some form of contact between Bill Clinton and Trump, something like 6 weeks before they met or had a phone conversation or something before he threw his hat in the ring. But anyhow, Charles, you were going to say something?
All completely ludicrous and a distraction. But yes, please, Charles.
Is it any more ludicrous than a Trump presidency, which we're languishing in right now? Anyhow, go ahead, Charles.
I want to throw in another film, which is a classic. You guys, I'm sure, have seen Z by Costa Gavras, which was, again, the same sort of power play where the reformers come in and they're going to expose the corruption of the ruling class. And then, of course, they get shunted aside and marginalized by the end of the film, right? So it was all for naught, in other words, you know. But I want to speak real quickly to Jesse's point about complexity, which is... interesting on many levels, and I'll introduce a couple of what came to my mind. One was, why did Rome fall, right? Western Roman Empire, not the Eastern Roman Empire, which lasted into the 1450s, right? Why? Well, we're still uncovering dynamics now. You know, like there was a book called The Fate of Rome, which is fascinating, which came out a few years ago, about the impact of pestilence and climate change, you know, on the food source, you know, in the Mediterranean, which once that degraded or declined, then, you know, it just became harder to field armies and so on and so forth. And so it goes to show in really complex societies, and to some degree, all societies are complex, then we can be looking back 2,000 years and still, or 1,800 years or 1,500 years, and trying to sort out exactly why did this happen, you know? And complexity is certainly real, you know, even in so-called less technological societies, there was immensely complex transactions and movements of people and cultural trends and so on. The other point I want to bring up is, to me, I would emphasize in the French Revolution the power of the idea of the idealism of the movement, right, which was liberty for all and so on. Now, of course, there were economic forces, right? The currency had been destroyed partly because the French monarchy had supported and gone bankrupt, essentially supporting the American Revolution against the British Empire, right? I mean, it was the French fleet that basically won the war, right? They moved in, blocked Cornwallis. That was the end of Yorktown, right? So they'd spent an immense fortune supporting the American Revolution. And so anyways, inflation was super high, you know, like the cost of bread peaked the week that the Bastille was torn down by hand, right? So there's a lot of complexity in something like the French Revolution, but I'm reading a history of the early American Republic right now, and the author takes, Gordon Wood, takes a lot of pains to describe the impact of the French Revolution's ideology on the rest of the world, that it triggered the slave revolution in Haiti, for example, which was a French holding, and it created this kind of break in the elites, the political elites in the U.S., where the federalists were sort of still in the British school, of Britain's political system was the freest and best, and we're kind of in their camp, or we're copying them and improving their political system. And then the sort of what they called Republicans at the time, Thomas Jefferson and so on, which found tremendous inspiration in the French Revolution. Like, yeah, that's what we have to do more of that and less of this Federalist British stuff. And so there was this huge deep divide in the political class that played out as a result of the French Revolution. So that's a topic we could go on and on about, but I'm curious what you guys think about that bit.
Well, I think that there is a romanticism to not just ideas of liberty, but ideas in general. And I think that that kind of meta ideology is very much driving our current crisis. Partly because I think the elites have been ideologically bankrupt. I mean, I think, Mark, you brought up the fourth industrial revolution and the, you know, a way in which there's been a really mediocre, if not pathetic, attempt to try to articulate the internet, to try to articulate AI, forces of decentralization into some industrial frame. And I think, you know, that's an example of the ideological bankruptcy of the kind of lack of vision, the lack of narrative that have been coming from quote unquote elites and institutions, that I think if there was an equivalent romanticism, if there was an equivalent kind of ideology, it would be very ripe. And I think that's what, you know, anti-racism offers. I think that's what anti-sexism offers. I think that's what anti-pedophilia and anti-sex crimes. I mean, there is a real righteousness to get behind a moral cause and feel as if you're making a difference. And I think that that is something that a lot of people are turning to and are finding, which on a micro scale can be great. On a macro scale can be the terror or the equivalent of the terror. And I think part of what we're all saying is it can all be a prerequisite to the coup within the coup, or the zealotry within the zealous people, to then take over that energy and take over that kind of sentiment and take it on to a next level. And, you know, it's part of the reason why extremist ideology right across the political spectrum is seeing a resurgence, right? People are looking for meaning, they're looking for purpose, and extremism has always offered that. Not to be cliche, but the larger question is who can cross over? Who can go mainstream, right? Who can take their vision of an alternate form of society and present it in a way that people say, yeah, I believe in that. And that's where what I've been thinking about since last week's episode, one of the things from last week's episode that really kind of has been rattling within me, partly because of the three of us, I understand monetary and economic the least, right? Most of that stuff is really over my head. And part of what interests me in the two of you guys as writers is you make it accessible to me. You help me understand monetary theory. You help me understand macroeconomic theory in a way that I find relevant and accessible. And yet last week, part of the thing I left for was if blockchain or Bitcoin were an alternative financial system, and if whoever controls the money controls society, then I don't want Bitcoin, because the guys who control Bitcoin are not the people I want running society.
I remember that comment.
And it kind of made me think the power of incumbency, the power of a status quo, is that you don't have to be great. You just have to be a little bit better than the other bozos. And I think that's part of the power that the current financial elite has, is that they've created a myth, they've created a narrative that they're better than the other bozos. It used to be that the other bozos were the communists, the Soviet Union, and they were right. They were better than those idiots running the Soviet Union. And the 80s, 90s, the thousands, they got away with kind of making it hard for any other alternative to emerge, right? It was the victory lap of capitalism and did everything in their power to make sure that no other alternative could ever be considered, right? Porto Alegre and Brazil and the World Social Forum tried. They were one of the biggest contenders of providing an alternate vision, the World Social Forum being an alternate to the World Economic Forum. But there haven't really been any alternatives until the Bitcoin stuff came along. And the Bitcoin stuff is a technical alternative, but I would argue still crap. So where there, I think, is an opportunity is for, and this is where I think in the last 10 minutes ago, we talked about charisma and influence. And now I'm trying to bring it to economic theory and monetary policy, that I think there is an opportunity for someone to say the existing system is corrupt. It doesn't work. Those guys are crooks. We throw the bums out. But they don't have a better system that they could offer. And I think most people fear the coup within the coup. That even though a new system could be possible, most people are aware enough to go, yeah, but who is it then vulnerable to? Who's able to come in and exploit that new system and take advantage of the rest of us? And to me, that's the Facebook example. That Facebook comes and says, we're a better example of media. We're a better example of whatever. And look at the assholes who they benefit. So I think we're caught in a paradox where we know that the status quo needs to be tossed out, but we don't really have a compelling alternative in terms of what to replace it.
My next book. Go ahead, Mark.
Do you want to go ahead, Charles?
No. I want you to go ahead. I had to just throw in that pitch, that blatant.
It was like a rim crash, like a doosh. It was perfectly timed.
Yeah. I want to quickly touch on something when Charles, you were talking about the fall of Rome, that sort of ties in with something Jesse said last week. Because as I go through the Sovereign Individual book, they point out that, you know, when Rome fell, the Western Roman Empire fell, no one sent out a memo to say that this has occurred. And that right up until Charlemagne, Charlemagne thought he was the Caesar, right? And it's not until, like, in retrospect, people look back at it and say, you know, here we are, 450, 475, whatever. That was the end. And then we went into this other period of history. And I think, you know, and what Jesse said last week was we're already in an authoritarian state. So I believe we could go for a couple of iterations or cycles where various factions of elites and leaders and political leaders and nation states actually think that they are the relevant organizing power in people's lives before they sort of understand. They may never understand it. It might be in the rearview mirror when people say, yeah, this stopped mattering here. And they figured it out here. On the Bitcoin thing, I understand the fear around that. And I'm glad you mentioned the Facebook as the coup within the coup, because that is also the recurring theme that we talk about a lot. When I explain this podcast to other people, I say we ruminate, you know, we think about the end of the nation state, and then we ruminate that the next phase is going to be Google and Facebook. You know, on Doug McKenty's show, he was talking about, you know, one world government. And I'm like, one world government, like that ship is sailed. It's over. You know, that's never going to happen. But we have to worry about snow crash with Facebook and Google and all that kind of thing. So on the Bitcoin side, where I see some optimism and some hope there is because the most insidious effect of the current monetary system is the Cantillon effect, right? It's like, especially since 1972, when the world reserve currency was split off from a hard backing, so you could just print this value out of thin air. So that effect of being able to print money out of thin air magic beans that you then hand to all your friends, and they can invest it in stuff, in assets that go up in value, and by the time it gets to the rest of the population, they only experience it as cost of living inflation. That's the sort of basis of a lot of the problems today. Where Bitcoin sort of takes that punch bowl away is to say, okay, you can't invent money out of thin air anymore. The source code is open, so everyone can look at it, and anyone can contribute to it, and there's a whole process. So the thing about Bitcoin and then the whole cryptocurrency phenomena is that it's open source and consensus driven. So if you don't want to live in a world that's governed by a central governing authority, Bitcoin. Go ahead.
I feel that we're off track, partly because at some point we could rename this podcast The Cantillon Effect and Friends.
Yeah, I know. I rant on that a lot.
A recurring theme. And I understand the argument that the Bitcoin people make. And I'm not saying that we have room for it to discuss it on this episode. I think we could space this out over many episodes as stupid Jesse tries to wrap his head around, why would I support those Bitcoin bozos over the current bozos? Because I don't feel the arguments being made. Right? Like, I get Bitcoin in theory, but Bitcoin in practice is pretty nasty and pretty messed up. And we can get into why that's the case. And we can get into the limits of open source. And we can get into the limits of, does it matter whether you can create currency out of thin air versus having that currency programmed? And who benefits from that? Because I still feel that we're in the domain of elites. Because I think the average person does not necessarily understand how the Bitcoin or the decentralized cryptocurrency system benefits them. Because if I can't understand that, I don't understand why someone who doesn't pay any of attention to this would understand that. And that's my point about, I don't feel that a viable alternative is being presented. Because technically, I sort of understand why it's the case. But there's no way I'm going to be able to explain that to some layperson in a way that gets them to go, no, I like our current system. Thank you very much.
Okay. I won't belabor this point too much, but could you understand this? Would you rather get paid in a currency that loses purchasing power over time, or would you rather be paid in a currency that gains purchasing power over time?
I can't answer that question because I don't feel that I'm informed of the choices.
Okay, let me jump in here with a third.
Okay.
That there's a lot of assumptions that of knowledge that you possess that allow you to think of those choices. And when the Bitcoin people present it, what I see is a shell game, that they have more knowledge than I do about those choices. But do I understand that choice? No, I'll tell you how most people live. They spend the money when they get it.
Okay,
worried about its value down the line. Spending the money as they're getting it.
Put all that aside. Sorry, Charles, we're elbowing you aside for a moment. And that's actually part of, this is an outcome, a symptom of suppressing interest rates for so long, is that people have no understanding of what saving means anymore. When I was a kid, I had like $100 in a bank account, and it was just seemed magical that over, like, by the time I was, my next birthday came, that $100 had suddenly grown to be $108. It was like out of this world. And then the next year, that $108 earned like even more than $8.
We don't need to get into the psychology of saving. We can just both agree that yes, people don't know how to do that anymore.
And because of that, when faced with a choice, would you rather have a bank account that gets stronger over time or a bank account that gets weaker over time? You get an answer like, I can't answer that question.
Because I don't have a bank account. And that's my point. Okay. Most people don't have a bank account. They don't have anything in the bank.
Okay, so I've got to break in here.
Let Charles talk.
Go ahead. Okay. And say, Bitcoin is a specific cryptocurrency. It was the first one, right? It introduced this technological innovation of the blockchain. But that is not the end of the development or adaptation of that technology, which is a decentralized way to generate currency, right? So in my scheme, I'm talking about a labor-backed cryptocurrency that's only issued when somebody performs work in their community that the community has decided is valuable, necessary, needed, fills a scarcity, right? And so it doesn't have to be profitable. But in that sense, labor then is the source of the capital that's being issued in exchange for the labor, right? And so if in my kind of conception of it, then that kind of gets away from any kind of elitism, because the currency is issued at the source, and each community group, right, they pay their members when the work is verified, you know. And so I don't want to go on and on about my idea, but I wanted to bring up the idea that there are many possible variations of this technology that could be truly decentralized and truly self-organizing, which, you know, I understand Bitcoin is not, right? I mean, it's decentralized, but it's not the same way as what I'm suggesting, you know.
And the idea, the idea that Charles is talking about is his climb system, talked about in A Radically Beneficial World. We'll link to it in the show notes. Go, Jesse.
And we've spoken about it previously in the podcast, and I hope that you keep bringing it up, because I love it. And I think it's a fantastic example of the types of currencies that can and should be created by communities to empower communities. But economics does not exist in a vacuum, right? That's why I like the word political economy, right? The elite are able to maintain control of the financial system because of power, because of politics. And Bitcoin is in the position that it is because of power and because of politics. There's a reason why they refer to every other cryptocurrency as a shitcoin. It's because they're deliberately trying to delegitimize the competition, right? And they will use the same tactics that any empire would to prevent competition, to prevent threats to their power, because power desires more power. And that's where I'm not just critical of Bitcoin, but I kind of wonder, how do we get these alternatives when either the status quo or aspires to the status quo will resort to dirty tricks and violence to eliminate any opposition? Because to take Charles's example, I would love to see a labor-centric cryptocurrency that used the technology both to maintain integrity, security, and transparency, but because it's open source, allow communities to start it on their own and not be beholden to some other power, or not be beholden to some corrupt power. But that requires a revolution, right? Like, that literally requires overthrowing the government and kicking out the banks. And this is why we're talking about the French Revolution, because those types of institutional and social change do not happen without substantive upheaval, right? Without society as a whole saying no to the old way and open themselves up to the new way. And yet the risk that we all acknowledge is that as soon as you entertain one thing, you open the door to all sorts of other nasty things, which will use that opportunity to jump into the mix and take advantage of it. And I say this in the context of, that's why I want the alternative to be robust. That's why I want the alternative to have legs, to be popular, to be accessible, to be easy. That's the brilliance of freedom as a revolutionary idea, is that it's easy. Everybody can wrap their head around it. It doesn't require a PhD to understand what freedom of speech and freedom of assembly and the freedom to do. Like, it's a virus that is so easy to transmit and so easy to receive. And we're now in a current point where we need to either retool that virus and reintroduce it into the population so people are resistant to authoritarianism, or in the context of an economic or monetary system, come up with something that is so easy and so straightforward, which is why I like what Charles is talking about, that people can wrap their heads around and go, yes, that is better than the one that we've got from these bozos. Let's forget about the bozos. Let's dump them out and let's go through our own system. And that's my big critique of Bitcoin, that yes, it could allow for a technical alternative, but the current crooks running Bitcoin are going to do everything they can to make sure that's not the case. And there's already a lot of money invested in that microeconomy, soon to become macroeconomy, that they will do whatever they can to make sure that there is no Dogecoin, that there is no Litecoin, that there is no labor coin, or however you want to call it, that could provide a viable alternative.
So when I hear you talk about the Bitcoin maximalists, you sound a lot like how I think we must sound to you when we talk about institutional elites, right?
Yeah, because, 100%. Great
because analogy. there's more to crypto and there's more to Bitcoin than the Bitcoin maximalists. Now, some of the most popular evangelists are Bitcoin maximalists. I've never
but look,
been one.
We could pick on the cult of Vitaly and the cult of Buterin too, right?
Exactly. Yes, we could. But just hang on. None of this would be possible without Bitcoin. Bitcoin, the Satoshi paper, okay, that was the 4-minute mile. It was something that all of humanity didn't think was in the realm of possibility, and then suddenly it was. Okay, so you have to at least give it that credit. And I've said a lot of times, I mean, we're in the very early innings of cryptocurrencies, and what finally wins, you know, or achieves escape velocity may not be Bitcoin. It may not even exist yet, right? But my point about it is that it takes the activity of money creation away from the priesthood of, you know, the people who, you know, the inner circle of
But isn't
bankers.
It just creating a new priesthood?
Not really, because if you don't like it, people can glom onto the idea and say, we like this, but if we don't like this cryptocurrency, we can start our own cryptocurrency, we can have this other, we can fork it. That's why the consensus element of it is so important.
But how's that different from our current system?
Because it can,
I could create a communist society tomorrow.
No, you can't. What you can't do is you can't start printing your own currency and say, Jesse dollars, do you know what I mean? Like, they succeeded in creating a new asset.
It would just be illegal.
My point entirely, right? They succeeded.
But the law doesn't matter if you're overthrowing the state.
My point is, okay, they have succeeded where all other previous attempts failed.
Okay,
there was e-gold in the digital gold currencies in the early 2000s, and they're all dust in the wind right now, okay? So
and look, we could argue about this forever, because I also want to say, did they succeed or were they just in the right place at the right time?
There is that. So, I mean, gold money or e-gold had horrible governance structure, and they were shut down by the government. But you know what? Before we wrap this up, you wanted to talk about something. You got some comment off the cuff.
So before I do, Charles, did you want to weigh in on this at all?
No, I think we've beaten the Bitcoin
to death.
I'm sure we'll come back to it, because I think it's an interesting topic, because it shows the difference between theory and practice, right?
Right.
Which has plagued all revolutionaries since the beginning of time, that you start the revolution based on a theory, but the act of the revolution becomes a mess. And what do you do to deal with that mess?
Well,
so
that's
speaking of messes.
That's the power play dynamic that we've hit multiple times through this episode. Okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. So I got, I published a post this past week, Future Fiber post on Fairlawn Gig.
Yeah,
which
we ran that.
ISP in Fairlawn, Ohio, which ran on Axis of Easy, which then, because Axis of Easy is getting increased attention and profile, the person who runs the marketing for Fairlawn Gig reached out to me and said, hey, I saw that you wrote an article. It's fantastic. You know, it's great. We got into a little conversation that he said, so I read the about page of Axis of Easy and I didn't understand it at all. Can you give me the layperson's definition of what Axis of Easy is? And I admit I couldn't. And you kind of alluded to this earlier, Mark, when you tried to describe this podcast. You were like, well, we kind of talk about, you know, Facebook and Google and the snow crash future. So I kind of think that our assignment for next week, and maybe we could ask our growing YouTube audience to post this in the comments, what is the access of easy? Right?
In like, one
what
line.
Do you think the access of easy is? Exactly. Like the
In
the,
one tweet. What is it?
Well, in a pithy summary. Like if you had to say to a friend, yeah, I was watching this Access of Easy podcast, like Access of Easy, what's that? What would the answer to that question be? I think that it would be a worthwhile exercise for us to return next week with some kind of answer as to what is the access of easy.
Right.
I have an email in my email signature now, Access of Easy, full coverage of a world gone full cyberpunk is what I call it. But
I would say
I think that's good, but I would say that's not a layperson because
yeah, what's
that's
cyberpunk?
Still jargon.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Mike.
Okay, well, I think I'll take on your assignment. My first thought is three guys talking about the new mythologies.
Yeah, not bad.
The new mythologies. I like that. Making the new mythologies easy.
Okay, let's write that down. Okay, well, I think that's a pretty good ending point.
All right. Okay, guys.
Talk to you guys soon.
We'll see you next week. Don't forget to like us on Stitcher, Spotify, YouTube. Hit the like button. Tell all your friends. AccessofEasy.com.